Welcome to this episode of Empower, the podcast where we delve into the intersection of women's leadership and affordable housing. I'm Nicole Graham, joined by my co-host Tanya Dempsey and Ashley Northcutt. And today we are honored to welcome a very special guest, Priya Jayachandran. Since early 2018, Priya has been at the helm of the National Housing Trust, an organization deeply committed to the preservation of affordable housing, right up our alley, advocating for public policy, lending, and energy sustainability. Her journey to this role is as impressive as it is impactful. From leading housing development at Volunteers of America to serving in the Obama administration at HUD, Priya has made remarkable strides in multifamily housing programs that we all use today. Before her public service, Priya spent over 15 years in community development real estate banking, where she was known for her expertise in affordable finance deal structuring. Her leadership led the Mid-Atlantic market at both Citi and Bank of America to top production office. As a consultant to women's microcredit organizations in Bolivia, an investment banking analyst, and a capital fellow with the California State Treasurer Kathleen Brown. Like, oh my God, is there a job that you haven't done? I'm not sure. You know, you also went to the University of California and you went to Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. By the way, that's also where Nicole went, both schools. We're so excited. Of course, you bring an amazing amount of energy, knowledge, expertise to the role that you have at the National Housing Trust. So, you know, let's just get into it. Like, you are amazing.
And we're super excited to have you here.
Obviously.
Oh, aren't you sweet? I wish my kids and my husband could hear all of that. But no, I think of you two as like these amazing women rock stars. And I love that you're the co-CEOs. I just think that that's so terrific and such a great model for our industry. Not one, but two cool women at the helm. So really excited for this conversation.
All right. So I'm going to jump into the first couple questions. As a woman who has had leadership roles in various sectors, what unique challenges and opportunities have you encountered?
I think that our field, one of the things I love about affordable housing is that there are so many women and women in leadership positions. There are few fields that I can think of that almost every sector has been helmed by a woman. I would say, you know, a few years ago, maybe banking was the exception, but Jane Fraser at Citi is really exciting that even at the upper echelons of banking, you're now seeing women. So I think that that's one of the really terrific aspects of our field. I will say that I think if there's a weak spot, it tends to be the heavy finance aspects. So I do think that, you know, it's exciting that Priscilla Almodovar is now leading Fannie Mae. And I think, you know, that's starting to change. But I think that some of the technical skills have often been more with men in those leadership roles. So I would say for the most part, this has been a great field for being a woman, for advancing. You know, I think what my answer is a little pat in terms of challenges, kind of the same ones that I think a lot of women have of that. You know, I don't love the phrase work-life balance. It's just life. But, you know, having kids, I know that I intentionally turned down some roles when my kids were younger. And I think that it's the right thing to do. I would do it again. But it also doesn't feel great at the time because if you're ambitious, and I think that ambition is an underrated quality in women, then you're slow. You're having to put that ambition on pause.
Yeah, your answer hit on so many really important and interesting concepts.
Paul and Tanya, I want to ask you all a question related to that. Is there any reason linked to that answer about being co-CEOs at your company? And I'll tell you why I asked why you think. Because I think women that are juggling, raising children, probably taking care of older family members and companies are some of the most talented people in the world because one thing I always say is, I know my husband has like a drawer and he opens it, that's work. And then he closes that drawer and then it's home life. I don't, I'm like spaghetti, like I'm making vet appointments, I'm cooking dinner, I'm on a Zoom call. they don't, a lot of time that skill set is huge. So is there any relation?
I mean, totally. Absolutely. Yes. You know, and I think that how you describe that with you and your husband, right? That's exactly what we saw with the pandemic too, right? Where it was like, so many of the men that I spoke with, right, were like, working at home was like so hard because they are used to completely compartmentalizing and like it's work and then it's home. And those of us who have been kind of juggling that for decades, it was a lot less of a transition because we're used to like, oh, okay, you know, yeah, you sit here, you're asking a question about your homework. You know, we're juggling a deal that's about to close. I'm getting a call from the caretaker who's, you know, taking care of my dad. But certainly,
yeah,
in terms of how we share things, that's a huge part of why we're co-CEOs and why it works.
Yeah.
Frankly.
What I loved about your answer, Priya, was also kind of highlighting that there's no shame in being ambitious and how that's such an underrated emotion,
because it is.
Right? Like women, if you are ambitious, that you got a title and that title's not nice, right? like it's not nice. And people are afraid to kind of lean into that. So I think one, you know, the co-CEO role is great. One, because it is trailblazing and it's like having another marriage, right? You have to trust your co-CEO enough with the decisions, with not being able, being vulnerable and being like, hey, guess what? I'm having a shit day because my kid broke her arm and I feel like a terrible parent and I need to like reshift my priority. And for her to be like, I got it. Like, I'll take X, Y, and Z. And that's actually, I think, pretty comforting in terms of like support and what our work culture is, right? Which is we bring our whole selves. Like, I loved that too. So Priya, like, tell me a little bit more about like how your experience kind of shapes the work culture that you're trying to push at NHT. Because I think that like, it's all related, right? You bring your whole self. It's not a work-life balance. It's just life. So like, does that drive some policy? And was that hard to kind of implement when you got there?
Yeah, I think so. NHT, like so many organizations, you're still seeing it, but I would say 5 years ago really did this generational shift. I felt like there were this whole cadre of leaders in the field that were probably approaching anywhere between 65 and 75 and retiring. And many of those organizations transitioned to leaders that were a generation younger, often women, often people of color, and it was a lot of change. I think that one thing that the nonprofit sector, I don't think, does as well sometimes as the for-profit sector is acknowledge that with a new leader, there's going to be a lot of change. I think we sometimes are a little Pollyannish about it. And we want that diversity. We want that woman. And we want, and then we don't want you to really change much. We want you to keep all the same people in place and we want you, everyone, to be happy. And I think at least in banks, new CEO, it was only a matter of days where you would get these emails that the CFO has decided to leave. Yeah, right. And the COO is leaving. And you just said, of course. That new CEO, new leadership team, I think that it's a little harder, I found, in the nonprofit sector, because you bring your full self and people say they want you to, but then boards are a little gun shy. They want it to everyone to be happy and sing kumbaya. And I think that that's a little unrealistic. And so I would say those first couple of years were a little bumpy of trying to both honor that and say, I'm not going to make that change, but then realizing, wait, I'm not that person. And so how do you bring your full self to it? And I think by mistake, but I do think if I were to do it over again, I would probably acknowledge up front and maybe push back a little that
being your full self means that there's going to be change, and it's okay for people to find it difficult. That's what change is. And some people may self-select out, or you may select them out, and that's all part of the transition. So I would say those, you know, first couple of years, trying to thread that needle in terms of bringing that perspective. You know, one of the first things I did was an easy one of parental leave. You know, nonprofits, at least in the DC affordable housing space, are not that good on parental leave. And I have to say, banks, I had my first kid in 2003 and I got 13 weeks of paid leave. I had all three when I was a banker and 13 weeks paid each time. And when I joined NHT, no parental leave period, let alone paid or unpaid. And then when we benchmarked many, I was surprised at how few offered paid parental leave. We initially started at 6 weeks and then excited this year, we increased to 13 weeks.
Yeah, so amazing. Like, let's just take them. Like, that is like true, I think, leadership and just like really pushing forward values. So like, yay for you. I do also want to say that like, that was one of Nicole's. So Nicole's been at CSG for 20 years. Yeah, I'm going to tell your story. And she has two kids and both kids she had at CSG. When she had her first kid, there was no parental leave. So like, she was still working. Like, I think that like a year after she was closing a deal in New York and brought her whole family, including her baby, because she was still breastfeeding with her, right? And the closing was 5 days long, just to feel like I should say that because it's totally insane. But, you know, when we started coming into leadership positions, it was even actually before we were co-CEO, she's like, we need to have this policy. And we do a lot of women's breakfast. And this is definitely one of the things that we talk about, because it's just like you said, like if you actually started benchmarking it, it's really surprising how people don't ask also, right? So like if you're a woman and you get pregnant, you don't like ask for a policy, right? You ask, there is no policy, and you kind of just like accept it.
That is what it is.
And move around it, right? And so you exit the workforce, like, right? There's all of these unintended, I think, consequences as a result of not pushing that forward. So I did want to give a shout out because, you know,
thank you.
You and Priya.
CPs in a pot. But I do think that's like, that's why it's so important that there are more women, you know, CEOs, presidents, leaders, right? Because, I mean, I bet if we were doing a statistical analysis and found like the correlation between number of paid weeks off and women leadership, I think we're going to find like a really strong correlation, right? So it just tends not to be, you know, the men in our firm and the men I'm sure that have, you know, led NHT and a bunch of other organizations, you know, it's real easy to take for granted that like, okay, I have kids, like that was interesting. Or, you know, that's they're at home and, you know, my wife is there and, you know, whatever is happening with that situation. But it takes the people that are making the policies to like really get in there and make those hard choices. So that's awesome.
Yeah. Thing too, because if you started a larger company, normally there is some sort of parental leave policy in. I just learned 7 years ago that the United States is one of seven developed countries that does not require maternity or paternity leave. You know, so that was eye-opening to me, and I think it goes back to ambition. If you're going to top schools, going to top huge companies, they have adjusted more to the times than when you step back into other companies. So that's interesting, and thank you, Priya, for doing that. And Nicole,
what other cool stuff have you done from a policy perspective?
Oh, so, you know, early on, it's so funny to think about this now, given where we are post-pandemic, but we didn't allow any telework at all. And I think that if people did say they were working from home, then there was just this assumption like, oh, how was your work yesterday? And so we were allowing up to 2 days a week. Maybe it was one. I can't even remember. Sometimes I pine for that. The 1 to 2 days as opposed to where we are today. But we did when that wasn't part of our culture to allow people, really acknowledging, right, that we all have laundry to do. We all have doctor's appointments, other things, and it's just more sane. So we allowed that. A big thing was also trying to be create more of a structure and transparency on salaries. I'm not going to lie, we're not one of those fully transparent. But what it was before, and I'm not going to pick on NHT, I think it was so common, is that you negotiated your salary with the CEO and everybody negotiated differently. And one of the things that struck me when I joined and I saw the salaries was A, how random they were, and B, almost it was textbook. The women were all paid less than the men.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was all a function of
how they negotiated.
And also, I think there was a little bit of a culture of sparring, and not everyone is comfortable with that or wants to do that.
Right.
And so what we did was create a grade system and a grade associated with positions with a transparent salary band with a minimum, median, and midpoint and max, so that everyone knows what your potential is in that, what the midpoint is, and creating some expectation so that you have more data with which to have that conversation on both sides, and that trying to address the outliers.
Yeah. And it really sounds like with that kind of system, right, like you're creating these guardrails.
Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like there's still likely some imbalance, right? Yep. Because within that range, there's probably a gender difference in like negotiating for the high end or not. Right. But like, at least you're getting people a lot closer together. So that's how many employees do you have?
We're now almost 60.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think the other thing is that like you want to create room for like you want like a large range of experience diversity, right? And so like I think you kind of need that range, because sometimes it's like, I really want that person. Mm-hmm. And they're like slightly overqualified for this position and underqualified for the other position. And so you kind of want to give yourself enough room. So it totally makes sense. I do want to ask a question about something on your website. You have a reduced emissions metric, which I think is like super interesting. And so I want to kind of dig in and ask a little bit about what kind of green initiatives, what kind of standards you guys have, and how you're kind of, you know, with IRA and all GRRP, how that's kind of going for you.
Yeah, I really want to give my predecessor, Michael Badakhin, credit. NHT embraced at that energy efficiency back around 2005, 2006, when really as an affordable housing preservation measure, NHT was created to focus on preservation. And it was at a time when there was limited room, I would argue there still is, to drive down so many of the operating costs. And both for owners and for residents, they're just fixed costs to run and build these properties. But the one really changeable place was energy burdens, utility burdens. And again, for both residents and owners, highly changeable. And so we started embracing at that time efficiency measures. Then you had 2008 and after the financial crisis, the ARA, which included the original GRRP, the I'm going to forget the original acronym, but we embraced that and did energy upgrades at several of our properties. And then, fast forward, we launched EFA, the Energy Efficiency for All initiative across 11 states with NRDC and Elevate Energy, really trying to drive uptake of efficiency measures by multifamily owners. Because the reality is that so many of the incentives from utility companies are focused at single family, and the dollars are modest. And so affordable housing owners often say, whatever, not worth my time. And I think particularly as climate change and the impacts of climate change have become clearer, and we're talking about not just efficiency anymore, but decarbonization and emissions, really trying to get more owners. So, you know, we've been on this journey, I'd say, for a good almost 20 years. And, you know, we're now at the point where, we're talking about decarbonization. We're talking about electrification, renewables. I would say, if I'm being perfectly honest, NHT was stronger on the policy side than we were in our own practices, in our own real estate portfolio. But I'm excited to say that's changed. And almost everything we do, we're building to a LEED or an enterprise green community standard. We're putting solar anywhere we can. We're developing community solar in multiple places, which I think is really exciting because most of the benefit is going to residents.
No, I want to talk about community solar.
Yeah. I mean, first, I just want to say, like, that's really awesome that you guys are such leaders, because the reality is, like, when you all are leading and, like, getting out ahead of the energy, that brings everybody else along.
Yeah.
Right. And, like, you know, I don't know how you do your statistic on your website, but I feel like we should take into account, like, a multiplier effect. Right. Because, you know, the reality is, like, if you guys are leading, then other people are like, oh, well, we've got to be like NHT. Like, they're totally going to kick our butts in, like, sustainability. And so you can really take responsibility for
others engaging.
Engaging. I don't think so. Anyway, yeah, I want to hear more about
community. Yeah. So community solar. So tell me more about community solar, because I think that in the IRA, there is language, right, where, you know, the solar is, you know, particularly the credit, right? There's like 30%, you could get a 20% bonus. And that bonus, though, you have to demonstrate that the tenants are actually receiving the benefit or some portion of that benefit. And so I'm curious, it sounds like you figured out how to do this in a way that's pretty cool. So I want to hear more.
Yeah, so community solar, for those who don't know, it took me a while to understand. There's maybe call it rooftop solar, where you're plugging into the direct meter of the building and offsetting the energy usage at that particular site. And community solar could be on a rooftop, but you're really just focused on the net metering and the virtual credits that you're generating. And those can be pushed to anyone. So people do community solar all the time. You may have people come to your house and trying to sell you, or you get flyers in the mail trying to sell you solar, even if your rooftop doesn't have access to sunlight. That's community solar. They've developed a site somewhere and they're giving you the benefit of it and selling that energy back to you, presumably at less than the utility would. What's special about what we and others are doing is that we're saying we're going to share that energy with income qualified individuals.
Of course.
Right. And so people who wouldn't normally have access to that. And in our case, we're giving it away free. We're not even doing discounting. We're saying that, you know, when you're talking about $20, $30 a month, it's just easier to push it all free. And oh yeah, we happen to be and lucky to be in DC, where they have a program, Solar for All. It's actually the federal program, Solar for All, is modeled after DC's program, where there is a upfront capital subsidy if you're committing to sharing the benefits with LMI individuals. So we've had two really cool partnerships, kind of ironically, with utilities. Our local electric utility, Pepco, has a substation where they had rooftops, and they are ground leasing us the rooftops at their substation. We did a community solar project and pushing all of the benefits to income qualified residents of the district. And the DC has what they call subscriber management. So they're managing how you find those people. But we've helped in spreading the word at our own communities. We do these registration fairs where we try and get our residents to sign up to say, hey, you could get free power. And then we partnered likewise with DC Water, our water utility, and they have a big reservoir in DC. And the reservoir is up on a hill and just, you know, underground water tanks. And we put solar panels all across the top of it. And 100% of that power being pushed to income qualified residents of the district.
I'm curious about, I mean, this is just a geeky question, so I just apologize. But like, if you had a voucher and you were getting a utility, right? Like if your utilities are free, is the subsidy just cutting you a check for that, right? Like, or, I mean, I don't know, is your, I'm trying to figure out like how that works, because I do feel like that this kind of program is also like about equity. And is there a way for us to borrow this program or look into this program or investigate this program to really be focused on like equity?
Well, I think that outside of the earned income tax credit, there are so few programs that actually give cash to residents. And this is one of the few ways, you know, a averted utility bill is real cash in your bank at the
in
end
your
of the
pocket.
Month.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It gets complicated, Tanya, with the utility allowances. I'm less familiar on the voucher side and more familiar on the PBRA side, the project-based Section 8. Sure. We and SAFE worked with HUD to, because it was actually a disincentive.
Of course.
Yeah. You didn't want to sign up for solar because by virtue of lowering your utility costs, you were lowering your subsidy.
Right. Increasing your rental payment. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it took a while and we worked with them to develop a new policy so that people are not disincentivized. It's a good question. I don't know how it works on the voucher side, but that was on the project-based Section 8 side.
We're so excited about what you're doing. When you were talking about equity too, Tanya, I'm just sitting here thinking how fabulous, because there's a such a gap between people that own their property and people that rent and getting money. So this is just amazing. I'll help investigate, Tanya, because this is amazing.
Right. I mean, think of it. It's like $20 a month. Like I'm like doing the math, right? Yeah. I'm like, well, $20 or $30 a month, right? Times 12, times five. Like, I don't know, man. Like there might be something there. Right.
And it's a regressive tax because your and my utility bills aren't that far off of that. There's a fixed cost, like, you know, no one's utility bill is really less than $30 a month baseline if you don't even use the utilities. And then when you do, it doesn't, you know, so people who are on fixed incomes and struggling, you know, are paying a much higher share of their income on utilities than
absolutely. So, okay. So basically you've spent most of your career in affordable housing. Tell us how you got into affordable housing and how essentially you've stayed.
I'll start backwards. I've stayed because I love the field. I think that I don't know many other fields that, you know, I love the mission. I think that's great. I think that sometimes we're not honest with ourselves. Yes, I do the mission work, but it's also really rewarding work. It's rewarding in multiple ways, including financially, right? There are lots of different roles. And I just think that what I've loved is that there are so many different places that you can play. And I've been able to move around a lot and still stay in the field and work at a finance level, at a management level, on a policy level, a practitioner level, all in the same area and do this wonderful work. I'm not Mother Teresa, I'm not going to lie. I love the mission of the work and that's what drew me to it. But I also, it's a really good place to have a career. It brings that mission, but also this variety of opportunity, areas to advance, great mentorship. opportunities in the public, private, nonprofit sectors. So it's terrific. How did I get into it? My first job out of college was a California fellow. It's a program that still exists. And I was a biochemistry undergrad. I thought I wanted to do healthcare policy. But at that time, Kathleen Brown was this up-and-coming Democrat, and you were required to do 10 interviews, regardless of what you, if you knew where you wanted to land. And I knew where I wanted to land. And after that interview in that office, I ditched all of my plans and said I wanted to work there. It's funny, at the time, Jerry Brown was the crazy older brother who was the ex-governor, and you know, no one would have predicted his comeback, but Kathleen Brown was going places and this dynamic woman leader. So I worked there, and great experience, but learned that, saw this finance as this tool. It wasn't rocket science, but I needed to learn it. And I saw it as this, the secret language. And I went and worked in as an analyst in public finance investment banking for a couple of years. And it was great. I learned that finance. It was a whole lot more investment banking than it was public. And so at the end of, I had the opportunity to stay and wanted to do something different and went to grad school and debated whether I do business school or policy school. And Nicole, you went to Woody Woo /SPIA and you know, really just saw that I liked the curriculum and the courses much more. And somebody gave me the good advice, like, look at the classes, which excites you more? Like these classes. And so went there and it was a terrific experience. And my parents are immigrants. I think that I always appreciated the humility that comes of being a immigrant. And I think if I look back, it seems so naive and silly, but I think I thought that I could replicate that. And I wanted to try and have that same experience. And so I decided I wanted to go to a developing country and work. Well, what I didn't realize is that you really can't pretend scarcity. It's not just the immigrant experience. It's the cultural, it's the financial, it's that, and you know, being an expat in Bolivia and, you know, working for a multilateral is hardly the same, but still it was a good experience. And I came back and my then boyfriend, now husband, wasn't looking to live in the developing world. So I came back to New York and realized, you know, if I couldn't be based in abroad, I didn't want to be on a plane all the time. So I set my focus on being in affordable housing and community development finance. And I don't know if people, I don't think people do this as much. I'm old, but when I was coming of age, people used to read The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. And everyone who reads The Fountainhead must go through a phase where they want to be an architect or want to work in buildings. I mean, her politics are crazy, but she writes a really good story. So I really liked that idea of being around buildings and the tangible stock. And if I couldn't be an architect, then I wanted to be around the built environment. And I had this policy background and interest. And so just I did 45 informational interviews in New York. Like one person led me to another person, led me another person.
I'm like, wait, up there. 40? Okay, so I'm an extrovert. I love talking to people. I feel like when I also lived in New York. I feel like I did a bunch of informational interviews too. But the idea that you did 45 to me seems like, what were you looking for?
Yeah, well, part of it is I didn't know what I was looking for. Yeah, I was 1999. Yeah. I come back and I am not an extrovert. And I just remember being exhausted at the end of the day. But, you know, talking to people, and I think it was equally looking for a job, but it was trying to figure out what I wanted to do and hearing people's stories. I think that informational interviews are just this underutilized tool because people are non-threatened. You're not asking for them. You're asking them to tell their story. Who doesn't like telling their story?
Very gratifying. Right. It's very gratifying as the interviewee. Right. And yeah, no, that's wonderful.
I love that story, Priya, so much. It filled my heart because there are so many parallels. Like, I knew our backgrounds had some parallels, but like just the devotion to the mission and yet like wanting a lot of opportunities and career trajectory and things like that. Like, I think that's a really nice and achievable balance, particularly in affordable housing, from like big things like that to Kathleen Brown. So when she ran for governor, she came to UC Berkeley and I was the student that got to introduce her. So I have like,
ooh, cool.
So I have this like thing.
You guys are it's like, we were meant to do this.
We were meant to. But also, as you talk about your journey and like your 45 informational interviews, I just want to say on behalf of everyone in affordable housing, I'm so grateful that you found where you were going to go and like that you developed this career that we can all
benefit from.
Exactly. Yeah. Like,
yeah, I mean, like, look, the nuggets are amazing, right? So it's like parental leave, energy policy, wage gap, benchmarking. I mean, these are just like what we talked about just now, right? Mm-hmm. Plus like, right, having really great mentors and putting yourself out there and doing these informational interviews. I think those are like, you know, for our listeners, mm-hmm. I feel like there's a lot of takeaways from just this like very short period of time talking with you.
Yeah. And also, I just want to echo and like shout out to all the other introverts in the world. Right. So I appreciate how much energy that takes to do all those informational interviews. And so I just want to, you know, clap for that.
Thank you. Yes. People. Yeah.
Right up my alley.
I was thinking a lot along the same lines, and I want to make one other point, but I side with Tanya on that. I'm very much an extrovert. We could probably go on 75, but I also thought it was so cool that you knew where you were going to work. It was dead set. But you met a powerful woman at a totally different company and saw like, oh, wait, like that energy is amazing to work for a powerful woman leader. So I love that that was how you.
Yeah. Yes. Funny how little things like that just totally change your career path.
Yeah, absolutely. So we want to be super respectful of your time. We have 5 minutes left. We just want to say you're kind of amazing. Thank you so much for your time today and joining us on this podcast.
Thank you for the opportunity. It's been great. I've had a lot of women mentors in my career. I think that's another thing I love about this field. And it's gratifying to be at a stage and an age to pay it forward. So it's a fun opportunity and I admire both of you. And one of the things I love about affordable housing, it really, there's so much still to learn. I feel like I know, first of all, I hate that there's this artificial distinction between like multifamily and public housing. It's all multifamily housing, right? It's all rental housing. And why we as a policy have chosen to distinguish, I think, has really bad ramifications. But I know one side of it and I don't know the other side, but it's really exciting. And you guys do. And I think it's so neat to see that there are these really rock star women in all of the different subsets of affordable housing.
Yeah. I mean, that's a full circle entrance to you, Ashley, on the Women's Affordable Housing Network. I mean, she couldn't have set you up better.
Completely agreed.
I appreciate it. But I want to reiterate what Nicole said earlier, that I think the affordable housing industry is so lucky to have someone like you. And I'm just so grateful that you met that woman and pivoted your career and have done so much. And I know half of our network on here would be like just cheering if they were on this call to hear all of the things you've done for women along the way and companies and the industry. So thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much, Priya. We really appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Oh my God, I always forget. What is your favorite food?
If you were on a desert island and had to choose one for the rest of your life,
right? What would you choose?
Dosa, the Indian fermented pancake.
Yes. Wow. I choose French fries with cheese.
Nicole, yeah, I wouldn't live very long because it's not super healthy, but it would.
I would just say health. There are no health ramifications.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll just add that to the question. But yeah, okay. I'm burritos. So
I'm chocolate. So I'm going early with you, Priya.
Yeah. Unless it's dark chocolate, Ashley, and then you're going to live long.
We talked about this on our podcast. I'm super dark chocolate. It took me years of rehab, self-rehabilitation to get to the healthy chocolate. Nicole has no time for that. So,
yeah.
But, well, if we all get stuck on the same island, we have quite a variety. So that's good.
Yeah.
Very excited.